Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplexes and at the art house.
Warehouse, farmhouse, hen house, outhouse, or doghouse in that area.
You'll also hear about new and old films on Blu-ray and on DVD. Plus, you'll hear all the latest Hollywood gossip.
I don't care!
Okay, maybe not the latter, but it is time for Film Sociology with WFYI's film guru.
Kaiser Shizzy!
No, that's Matthew Sosi.
It's such a fine line between stupid and clever, yes.
Let's see how thin the line is. Here's your host, Matthew Sosi.
Lovers, welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD To The Point and WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Sosi. The show's available as a podcast, and it's also available on iTunes. The main crust of today's show is a fun, lively chat I did with author Steve Taravella, who's written a book, Mary Wicks, I've Seen That Face Before. And I'll get to why we're doing this chat in a little bit, because the book came out in 2013, but it is an example of social media used for good, not for evil. Yes, the Academy Awards happened. The nominations came out this week. I'll get to that in a moment, but I do want to make quick note of opening in theaters this week is Maze Runner, The Death Cure, and it's the third one, and I don't think I've seen any of them. So moving on, we also have the Western Hostels with Christian Bale, Rosamund Pike, Wes Studi, and a slew of others. This is written and directed by Scott Cooper, who had quite an up and down. He's got four films under his belt since 2009, and all have really solid performances in them. Of course, his first film was Crazy Heart. That's the film, of course, that got Jeff Bridges his Best Actor nomination finally. A film that I remember was a good film, but a great performance. And I actually, one of the few films I wouldn't mind it being longer because I wanted to spend more time with the Jeff Bridges character. He follows it up with Out of the Furnace, which a bit of an overwrought drama set in the set in the backwoods that's with Christian Bale, Casey Affleck, Zoe Saldana, Woody Harrelson, Sam Shepard, Willem Dafoe. I mean, a quite the cast. Just a little overwrought, in my opinion. He follows that up with Black Mass, which was his Boston crime drama with Johnny Depp, really good as Whitey Bulger. And this was a film that it was a Boston crime drama that we've been oversaturated with Boston crime dramas, but there was a Shakespearean tone to this one. Hostels has Christian Bale, as I mentioned, Rosamund Pike, Scott Shepard, and it's the story of is set right after an army captain who has to escort a dying Cheyenne chief and his family through dangerous territory so the chief can die in his own land. So we have race relations, we have the Western. It's a really grim story. Good performance by Bale, but there if you've seen not just Westerns, but when you have to do road pictures, there will be some hurdles that need to be done outside the group and inside the group. That's not the most. You know, it's fairly predictable stuff. And if I have to keep quoting back to a film with a great Western with a racist protagonist, and we're talking about The Searchers 60 years ago, I know some critic in the ad campaign called it the best Western since Unforgiven. No. And this has been getting up and down responses from a lot of people. I thought it was a little heavy-handed, and when it comes to Mr. Cooper's work, it's more leaning toward Out of the Furnace than, say, Black Mass or Crazy Heart. So anyway, that is opening in theaters this weekend. I do want to mention, of course, at IU Cinema, If you're listening to this on Saturday at 3 o'clock, they're showing Patton. 7 o'clock tonight, Attack the Block, if you're a John Boyega fan. Sunday the 28th, the IHSAA State Basketball Finals from 1954 at 3 o'clock. And then Richard Attenborough's Academy Award-winning Gandhi at 6:30 p.m. Monday the 29th at 3 p.m., the musical from the 1944 Cover Girl, followed by The Sacrifice at 7 o'clock. If you're a fan of Robert Altman, Thursday, February 1st, The Long Goodbye, Elliot Gould as Philip Marlowe, is happening on Thursday the 1st. Friday the 2nd at 6:30 p.m., Something for Everyone from 1970. And then from 1972 at 9:30 p.m., The Thing with Two Heads, must see with Rosie Grier and Ray Milland. Oh, my. If you're old enough, have cocktails before seeing that. And then Saturday, February 3rd at 3 o'clock, The Day the Earth Stood Still. And then at 7 o'clock from 1965, Shadows of Forgotten Ancestors. So working ahead on that. Also at the Historic Art Craft Theater, February 9th and 10th, Friday and Saturday, 2 and 7:30 p.m., they will be showing Breakfast at Tiffany's. I want to catch up on some films. As I mentioned, in the last couple of weeks, I've been catching up on films that have been sent to me because I had the end of the year Academy Awards stuff to consider and the IFJA stuff to consider. So I do want to mention there's a good documentary called The Settlers, which is about Israeli settlers in the West Bank after the Six-Day War of 1967. And the film, you get quite a bit of history behind what has happened between Arabs and Israelis after 1967. So you do get a bit of a history lesson, and I know this is very touchy material. For me, especially the first half hour is a history lesson. I wish there was more about the actual settlers themselves. You get some, but for me, not enough. But if you need to know that part of the world, because you should, that's worth checking out. There's also a film called Thebe, which was the nominee for Best Foreign Language Film last year. And it's set in the Ottoman Empire in 1916 when a young boy tags along with his older brother to escort a British officer across the desert. So we have camels, we have desert. Imagine a Western, but it's the Ottoman Empire in 1916. That's the beauty of so-called foreign films, is that you can have universal stories, even if the look is slightly different. So if you're a fan, actually, I think this is a better Western than Hostiles. So anyway, that is out. These are both courtesy of Film Movement. Also got to see the Robert Muggy documentary, Gospel According to Al Green. And this was done in the 80s when Al Green had stopped doing R&B and soul and was strictly doing gospel music. He had a church in Memphis, a church I actually got to visit, oh my gosh, about a decade ago. But it captures an interview in studio with Green, a couple of in-studio performances, but then him conducting a service at church and putting on a gospel music concert. So if you're a fan of Al Green, you should know more about his gospel side. I used on the Blues House Party. Sometimes I play a little mixture of Saturday night and Sunday morning, and I think more people should know about his Sunday morning aspect. But yeah, quite a fun documentary to check out. Also on Film Movement, the 1966 Mexican Western Time to Die. This is from Arturo Ripstein, who became one of Mexico's most profound and most acclaimed directors. This is a story of a guy who spent 18 years in jail. The character, not the filmmaker himself. This is a gentleman fresh out of jail after serving 18 years for shooting a man in self-defense and coming back to his hometown to start anew. And, well, things get complicated. And it's a mixture. It has a spaghetti Western feel to it at times. There's some nice handheld work, which for 1966, when the film was shot, ahead of its time and hadn't really been tackled a whole lot. Not just even less so, I think, outside the United States. I can't wait for your correcting emails on that. But if you're a fan of also a better Western than Hostel. But very cool. And I think we forget that it had Westerns down south. And this is, again, it's not a spaghetti Western, and it's not an American Western, Mexican Western. But yeah, that's worth checking out. Also, this is a gentleman, this is a filmmaker that Brian, Alex Cox, if you're a fan of Repo Man, cites as a huge influence. And also on Blu-ray, because I get these. Want to thank VCI for this and the gang. But this is a film from Graydon Clark, who's actually been a guest on Film Sociology. He appeared at one of the conventions. I was able to have him in studio. His 1977 film, Satan's Cheerleaders. And this is a film, if you're a fan of cross genres, and I use an example from Dusk Till Dawn, if you know that. Of course, you know, written by Quentin Tarantino, directed by Robert Rodriguez, where it is first a crime film, crime road picture, and then it turns into the vampire movie. Not a spoiler alert on a 20-year-old film. But and Graydon Clark kind of did this format 20 years before that. It's the first half is low-budget 70s college cheerleader exploitation film, and then they get wrapped up and involved, whether they like it or not, with a satanic cult. And it actually does a decent balance. And, you know, for a 70s low-budget film, it's fun. And recognizable faces, John Ireland, Yvonne DiCarlo, John Carradine, Jack Krushen. But yeah, this thing had two commentary tracks. Yes, I listened to them both. So if you like 70s girls and you like cheap horror, let me correct myself, inexpensive horror, you can check those out. So yeah, some fun catching up on this. I do want to mention that I did get in mail this week, and I'm hopefully going to talk about it next week, because now I have on Blu-ray Attack of the Killer Tomatoes. It happens. All right. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org. We'll get to my interview with author Steve Taravella in a little bit, who wrote the book Mary Wicks. I know I've seen that face before. Yes, the Academy Award nominations were released on Tuesday. I got to do a little bit on RTV6. I guess that's still floating online if you want to check that out. Very short. But my response, my reaction. First off, I'm happy that my top film, my number two film, and my number four film were all nominated for Best Picture. You know, as a reminder, my top film was Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. Lady Bird was number two. Dunkirk was number four. My number three film was Lucky, which I didn't think would get a Best Picture nomination, but I did. I was hoping that Harry Dean Stanton would get a Best Actor nomination. He did not. He can't have everything. But some nice surprises in here. Kudos to Timothy Chalamet for getting a nomination for Call Me By Your Name, as well as Daniel Kaluuya for Get Out. And Get Out got way more than I anticipated. Really happy for Sally Hawkins in The Shape of Water. Shape of Water, of course, led, I believe, with 13. And, of course, that features Film Sociology guest and Ball State graduate Doug Jones. I think the supporting actor and actress races are more interesting, because you have Willem Dafoe for The Florida Project, as well as Sam Rockwell for Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. I think those are the front runners. And supporting actress, you have two wonderful actresses that have done theater and TV and movies and are really well-liked, and that's Allison Janney for I, Tonya, and Laurie Metcalf for Lady Bird. Again, the Jordan Peele got a directing nomination, as well as Greta Gerwig. Nice surprises there. So I try. This is the Film Geek's Final Four. This is the one I actually care about as far as coverage. And I'm also at an age where I try not to get too worked up about it. So, and when it gets a little closer to Oscar time, I'm sure I'll break these down. And if you want my predictions, for entertainment purposes only, never forget that. All right. With that in mind, there's a fun book about character actress, or as I like to call them, that lady, Mary Wicks, called I Know I've Seen That Face Before. And got to connect with Steve Taravella, the author, online, and you'll hear how at the end of this interview. But hope you're in for an epic chat. If you're a fan of old movies and TV, the That Lady Mary Wicks. Here's author Steve Taravella, author of Mary Wicks, I Know I've Seen That Face Before. Enjoy. Steve, to start with, tell me your first pop culture encounter with Mary Wicks.
Wow, that's a good question. I guess I remember seeing her as Miss Cathcart, the nosy, man-hungry neighbor in the old Dennis the Menace TV series. And I was just delighted with the energy that she brought to that. She was an annoying character by any measure, but there was something really lovable about her, wasn't there? So that was late 50s and early 60s. That's probably the first time I remember being conscious of her.
Okay. Mine was, I did a stage production of The Man Who Came to Dinner when I was in high school. And what has become practice for me is that, you know, once I get done with a play, I tend to, if there is a film version, I tend to seek it out just to watch. And, of course, she played the nurse in that. And, man, well, first off, I'm like, well, these are grown-ups doing this, not teenagers. But she was just on it. And then from then on, I think especially with a career like hers, you see her pop up in other things, whether it's 20 years old or recent, and she becomes that lady. And then there's, I think, a rite of passage when finally as a fan you have her name committed to memory. Was that the case with you?
Well said. I think that's a nice description of the kind of affection she engenders in people. And it's funny that you mentioned The Man Who Came to Dinner because that was really a career-defining role for her. It was her first big Broadway role. She originated that part in the George S. Kaufman show. Was the only stage performer from the production to be cast into film, which was her first major film. And then she went on to do other versions of it in television and radio and sort of felt that that part of Miss Preen was hers and, in fact, sometimes resented those occasions when other actresses were cast in the role. What part did you play?
Oh, it was my first high school role. I was one of the convicts invited over for dinner. Yeah, so I...
The show still... It still holds up all these years later, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's fun. You know, well, annoying guests who stay too long, that's universal. There is no fad.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
I guess, how did the book come about for you?
Well, I didn't set out to write Mary Wicks' biography, to be sure, but I had, as a journalist, always wanted to write a biography. And I found myself some years ago in a position where I could take about a year out of the workforce and work on a book. And I, some years before that, had always wanted to interview Mary, assuming I would write a magazine profile of her, because really she worked with everybody who was anybody, and I felt certain she'd have interesting stories to tell. So I started with her. I thought, well, let me look into it and see if her life was interesting enough to justify a book. You know, a book-length treatment, because really it might not have been. And I quickly decided it was. She had a fascinating life. The original Mary Poppins, which many people didn't know, the animator's model for Cruella de Vil in Disney's 101 Dalmatians, the work she did with Orson Welles in the 1930s and the groundbreaking Mercury Theater Company production. Those were all really... and those three examples, TV, radio, and film right there. Mary worked across the spectrum. And then when I realized that she was also Lucille Ball's closest friend for 30 years and part of that circle of, mid-last century comic performers, it just opened up other doors. And I decided, yeah, there really is enough here for a book, and approached the people who were managing her estate, who were a little apprehensive at first because Mary was quite a private person, but in the end gave me the support I needed to go ahead.
I would say it seemed like the biggest challenge besides as you mentioned, but I mean, finding peers of hers that were still around, still alive.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, I approached that rather methodically. I interviewed in the end almost 300 people, but plotted them out by age and started trying to reach those who were in their later years, essentially in hopes of catching them. And I missed some. I mean, I did find quite a lot of people in their 80s and 90s who worked with Mary when she was young or who knew her as a girl in St. Louis, including the girl who played marbles and dolls with Mary on the streets of St. Louis as a 5- and 6-year-old. But I also missed a lot of people, and missed them sometimes by almost comical measure. I mean, I remember phoning one woman in St. Louis who I was very eager to speak to. But the woman who picked up the phone said, "Oh, I'll have to call you back. I'm running out to her funeral right now." It was that kind of thing where, you know, by days or weeks, I missed some. It was sort of playing detective, you know, to catch people while they're able to share stories, because you really want those stories of someone's youth.
Mm-hmm. And what was her youth like?
I'd say she was raised in a rather repressive, well, maybe that's unfair to say right off the bat. I'd say she was raised in an almost Victorian conservative community in St. Louis, in a very traditional household. She was raised Episcopalian and raised to believe that church and faith and family were everything, and those are tenets that she carried with her whole life and that shaped a lot of her outlook on things. Church was always a very important part of her life. Even as an adult, she was a very active member of the All Saints Episcopal Church in Beverly Hills. She volunteered at hospitals. But I would say that that in some ways it was a repressive upbringing as well, and that shaped her too. Yet she remained very fond of St. Louis, and your listeners in Indiana might appreciate, of the whole Midwest in general. Mm-hmm. And in her later years, she even considered leaving Southern California and retiring back to St. Louis, where she grew up.
Does the city, I mean, is there a following with her in the city today? I mean, is there a street named after her? Is there still a legacy about her with the city?
Boy, that's a good question. In some circles, they would say yes. I mean, we have to remember that Mary now has been dead for what? She passed in 1995, so it's been quite a while.
Yeah.
There's not a street named after her. Boy, that would be nice. But your question reminds me that there is a star on the St. Louis Walk of Fame in Universal City. In Universal City, just outside of St. Louis proper.
Mm-hmm.
And she's there along with other famous St. Louisans, Betty Grable, Agnes Moorhead, Vincent Price, who was a very close friend of hers from her youth. Well, I think the last thing I would say to that question is, because she performed so many times at the very large, popular outdoor theater there, the Muni, officially the St. Louis Municipal Opera, she does have a following there among people who followed the performing arts. Yeah.
Okay. And what got her the bug to become an actor?
Well, I think Mary, who was decidedly unattractive from young, looked for ways to stand out and endear herself to people when maybe expectations of what a woman should look like or how a woman should behave were rather rigid, and she found it hard to succeed in that kind of setting. But when Mary was on stage, which she began essentially in Job's Daughters as a young girl, she always got a great reaction from the audience, and I think, like a lot of performers, thrived on that laughter and that feedback from people. It really gave her a boost of energy and confidence, and in the end, she decided to make that her career. That wasn't what she set out to do, I should say. She set out to study law. I mean, Mary was incredibly smart and clever and followed current events and enjoyed intellectual pursuits, but in the end, she didn't study law, and she didn't pursue a career in law. And some theatrical productions at the Little Theater in St. Louis persuaded her that, yeah, she could make a career of this, or try to. Mm-hmm. I suspect that her success at it surprised her as much as anybody early on.
And I know she wound up doing a lot of repertory theater on the East Coast, which was, you know, at that part of the 20th century, turns out to be great training for an artist.
You're absolutely right. It's hard for people today to appreciate how important those summer theaters were during those years. But places like the now called the Berkshire Theater Festival, but then the Berkshire Playhouse and other theaters in Cape Cod and in the Northeast during summers when people wanted to get where it was cooler and where air conditioning, because they were living where air conditioning wasn't so common, theaters were a big part of people's social life. And Mary did exceptionally well. She did well on stage in the sense that many, many reviews from local papers that I looked at, if they cited one particular performer, it was often Mary they singled out as being exceptional in the cast.
Mm-hmm.
And she did well offstage. She really made some lifelong friendships in those theater troupes, people who, you know, she carried with her for the rest of her life.
And also the fact that they were almost at times banging out a play a week.
Yeah, isn't that amazing?
To be, and you're rehearsing one show in the morning and maybe another show in the afternoon, and then you're doing a performance that night. And, you know, that's something you got to, you hope you're able to pass on, or at least let younger artists know that's how, at one time, that's how it's done. And in some cases, it still is.
In some cases, it is. You're right. There are a few theaters that still try that. I think it must be exhausting for the performers. But one thing about Mary to keep in mind is, boy, she loved hard work. I mean, she had this work ethic that was just incredible. It's almost as if it wasn't hard and tough and difficult, it wasn't worth doing.
Mm-hmm.
So Mary rose to every challenge. She wasn't ever somebody who looked for the easy way out. I think she really enjoyed those theatrical experiences early in her career.
When did she make the trip down to Broadway?
1939 was her first big Broadway show, and that was The Man Who Came to Dinner. So Mary was 29 when she first appeared as Miss Preen. And she at first was staying in boarding houses in Manhattan for young single women. And then as that as the run of that show progressed, she had saved enough where she was able to get her first small apartment to herself in Greenwich Village, and stayed in New York until the mid-1950s before the lure of television and a perhaps more constant paycheck brought her to Southern California, where she lived the rest of her life.
And it was it the trip to California that she solidified the kind of that lady status?
Bat lady? What do you mean, bat lady?
The character that you recognize. You don't know her name, but you recognize her face. Oh, it's her. It's that lady. This, you know.
Oh, that lady. Excuse me.
Yeah.
Excuse me. I would say you're right, because the parts that she got when she first arrived in California were not big starring parts. So they were the secondary roles that people might remember her from. So she was, for instance, in Short Order, the nurse with Betty Davis in Now Voyager. And many people today still remember that part.
Mm-hmm.
You know, wonderful comic relief, comic timing in a melodrama that was otherwise, of course, Betty Davis's picture.
Yeah.
And from there, she went on to many other memorable parts, a lot of the Doris Day pictures at Warner Brothers, some with Danny Thomas, and she really enjoyed those. And of course, then White Christmas, which many people know her most from now today.
Right. Actually, we'll get to that. But yeah, she even did an Abbott and Costello film, which I forgot about.
Yeah, she did. Are you an Abbott and Costello fan?
There used to be I grew up in Flint, Michigan, and there was a channel. It was a TV station in Detroit, and every Sunday morning they'd show an Abbott and Costello movie. So I've probably seen all of them several times.
Oh, how funny!
Yeah.
Well, I had not seen an Abbott and Costello picture in years before I began researching this, and I'd kind of forgotten how talented they really. I mean, I guess I didn't fully appreciate what a great performing duo those fellows were. And Mary with them was just wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And she loved that. Whodunit was the movie.
Right. So you mentioned White Christmas. So, I mean, at the very least, Mary Wicks is a part of everybody's, for many people, a part of their Christmas tradition when watching that movie every year. So there, and that's, a lot of people can't say that as far as their legacy.
You're right. And for that, I think she was always grateful, because A, Christmas as a holiday was very special to her, partly because of her faith and partly because of what family meant to her. And B, Mary often felt that she was overlooked in the industry. And White Christmas was if nothing else, a reminder once a year that she was part of Hollywood during an important time of output there. And she also just liked the film and the experience.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right. It comes up every year and people ask about her. I've spoken several times at the American Film Institute at Christmas when they screen that in introducing the film. And I love the reaction the film gets now, what, 60 or something years after it was originally screened?
Exactly.
It still has a place in American pop culture, and Mary would be thrilled to see that she's still part of that.
There is a moment I have, and this, I always think of this for all character actors everywhere, although my wife has an MFA, and she says all actors are character actors, but that's, you know, she's the smart one. but when she plants one on Bing Crosby, I have this image of character actors everywhere just standing up and cheering because the that guy or the that girl got the smooch a star, and it's one of my favorite moments in film.
Yeah, that's nice to hear you say. I think she might say something similar. And I share an anecdote in the book about how the scene immediately following that, where he comes in quickly for a second kiss very playfully,
yep,
and catches her off guard, was something that was simply ad-libbed on the set. But the director, Michael Curtiz, decided it worked well enough to keep it in.
Yeah, because it was sincere. It's funny. But it, and the fact that Bing Crosby didn't repel, that means a lot for you know, certain insecure artists that we all have inside of us.
Well said.
Yep.
Yeah.
I would say, how did she get the friendship going with Lucille Ball?
Well, I think they were women who had, in the first place, simply a lot in common. They were the same age. They were only 1 year apart. They both had an innate comic sense about life. They looked at things through an unconventional lens. They both liked to perform in front of people. They could both be rather severe and harsh at times. I mean, Mary, for all the wonderful things about her, didn't have a lot of warm, fuzzy edges to her, and neither did Lucille Ball. They met in the late 1940s on a television show when they were both guest starring in the same segment. And just formed a natural friendship. They lived rather close to each other. And Mary was as much a part of the Lucille Ball, Desi Arnaz family as anybody for a very long time. I would say probably less so when Lucille Ball married Gary Morton. But for 30 to 35 years, they really were extremely close. I mean, Lucille Arnaz describes Mary as absolutely her mother's closest friend. And she was at the home all the time. She was there for holidays. She traveled with Lucy. She bopped in and out of the house as if it was her second home. And they had a genuine affection for each other and just really enjoyed each other's company. In fact, it was Lucy Arnaz who gave the eulogy at Mary's funeral.
And it was the first time she appeared on Lucy's show. She was the dance instructor.
You're right.
Okay.
Yes. Mary appeared. She was one of Lucille Ball's favorite guest stars and appeared in 22 or 23 different episodes of various Lucy projects. But the first one was, in fact, the episode of I Love Lucy called The Ballet, where she was the severe, no-nonsense ballet instructor. Abba, Abba,
yes.
Abba.
I say, was that whole site? I mean, how? Let me try again. That whole dance class. I'm assuming that how much of it was scripted and how much of it was improvised on the spot, or at least in rehearsal.
I'm really glad you asked that, because people often assume that so many things in I Love Lucy, because of how hilarious and spontaneous they seem, were ad-libbed. But it's important for the reputations of those writers who worked so hard to point out that no, absolutely not. Very little was ad-libbed. And in that segment, nothing was ad-libbed. Everything was rehearsed and scripted and written down. And they performed it exactly as the final script was. So when Lucy gets her leg caught in the bar, mm-hmm, for your listeners who might remember that, that was scripted. That wasn't Lucy during filming slipping or anything. And every part of it was written out. And the spontaneity that came across on screen just really speaks to the talent of the two women.
You mentioned the fact that she was on several episodes of the series. I mean, in all the incarnations of the series. It reminds me of, I don't know if you ever watched Columbo when you were younger.
Oh, yeah.
So it cracked me up when, you know, you'd have somebody like Jack Cassidy or Robert Culp return as a different character. I'm like, no, that's a bad court system. Why are you letting him out? So you're like, wait, why is the dance instructor now working as a clerk? What, she lost her job? Because she's that recognizable. She's that lady. So
yeah. I love how you look at that. And I have to tell you, I'm a big fan of Columbo. But it kills me to turn on a Columbo rerun and see Jack Cassidy again.
Yeah.
I mean, you're absolutely right. But I'm also glad you mentioned that because of the many, many television performances that Mary gave. Honestly, one of my very favorites is an episode she did of Columbo. She played a nosy landlady who basically distracts Columbo with inane, meandering conversation when he's trying to get clear, quick answers from her as to her observations of some murder. And she does it so well, and she's so amused. And you believe that woman, that character. And it was a rather long scene.
Well, sure.
And I just loved it, absolutely loved it. Anybody who might not remember the woman we're talking about, because we're doing radio and TV and you're not able to show clips, you can find that episode online. I believe it was called, I want to say The Last Frame, as in picture frame, something like that. But if they Google Mary Wicks and Columbo, it'll come up and you'll see
there
it. Just a wonderful performance she gave.
And now that you mentioned that, I want that character and Columbo to be in a production of Love Letters. It'd be 3 hours, but it'd be fun. So.
You're right.
So, I mean, and I know Mary was constantly working. The thing about being a supporting actor or that person was, you know, you went to where the work was. You didn't, you know, whether it was the stage or TV or movies. And you know, in the middle part of the century, if you were a movie star doing television, that meant your career was over. Now, things have changed, obviously, in the last couple decades or so. But, you know, she had that thing of being able to bounce from one thing to another. But as I read in your book, she also wrote letters to producers, right, to just remind them that she's still around?
Yeah, which in some ways is very sad that somebody of her stature who did so much felt the need and, in fact, perceived an actual need. It wasn't a misperception that she had to constantly remind casting directors who she was and that she was there. But part of that, I think, comes from, well, as I say, genuine need to work and keep her face in front of producers and casting folks. But part of it was surely that she was, for her entire life, a single woman who supported herself, a working woman. She never made enormous salaries, not some of the salaries that maybe today's popular actresses would get, you know, and wasn't a top tier. And maybe in some years was paid less than a man would be paid for the same thing. So she really, she needed to work. A lot of it was financial. And because her family had suffered so much in St. Louis during the Depression year, she was also terribly insecure about money and finances, mm-hmm. Much more so than even actors who were regularly insecure, where's the next job coming from, kind of a thing. No, Mary was always frightened of not having enough money to live on.
Shifting gears a little bit, I didn't know this until I read the book, and I was so excited to hear that that lady, that a supporting character, got to play, I think, one of the more challenging roles in American theater. But she was in a production of The Glass Menagerie. How did that come about?
Yeah, isn't that interesting? How many people would think she could be effective at that? And yet those who saw it say she absolutely was. It came about because of the affection that I described earlier that Mary had for St. Louis in general and her alma mater, Washington University. She kept in touch with many people at the school. On occasion, she contributed funds to help the theater focus of the school grow. and worked with the head of the drama department there to find something that would bring her back as a performer in residence or teacher in residence. She actually did teach a couple of classes there in the theater arts. And they came up with that one. And it is surprising because not many people would perceive Mary as maybe skilled at conveying the kind of pathos and neuroses and extreme seriousness that that character needs to convey, but she did. And maybe it was the St. Louis nature of it that spoke to her, that, you know, the play happens to be set in St. Louis, mm-hmm. or the affection she had for the playwright, Tennessee Williams. I don't know, but I know she wanted to do it. She pushed for that. Surely, I think part of it is she wanted to show casting directors outside of St. Louis that she could do more than maybe the meandering landlady on Columbo, you know?
Right, of that course.
And she did. She did have some other interesting dramatic parts.
Is there any footage of that performance anywhere?
No, there's not. Not that I have found. The university doesn't have any, and I wasn't able to identify anybody who happened to take sort of home movies of it. So no.
Right. Well, worth a shot.
And
I know, of course, we're going in some form of chronological order, but I know it was cool to see her get a resurgence in the late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah, because how many people get to have a, as you say, a resurgence late in life?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, Mary was born in 1910, so, you know, late 80s, early 90s, when the Sister Act pictures came up, for instance, you know, she was approaching 80.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, that's exactly what did happen, a resurgence. And I would push it back even a little before Sister Act, the picture that she did directed by Mike Nichols, Postcards from the Edge.
Yep.
Probably set her on a higher profile path for the last number of years of her life. She loved doing that picture. It introduced her to new, younger audiences, put her opposite some wonderful performers like Meryl Streep and Shirley MacLaine and Annette Bening. And she had a great experience with that. But then, yes, the Sister Act pictures, which, to be honest, when I describe Mary to young people who might not know her from some of the things you've asked me about, I mentioned that because many of them remember more vividly the Whoopi Goldberg films,
right.
Sister Act. And yeah.
Well, that, and she has two nun franchises on her resume.
That's a great way to say it.
It's true.
You're right. She did the Sister Act pictures and absolutely the Trouble with Angels pictures. And that's now what I'm going to start calling those, the two nun franchises. Yes.
Well, and wasn't it in the Troubles series that I think there were a couple things that she had to do? And I thought the story is, of course, you always tell a director, when told, can you do something? You always say yes, even if it's not true.
Right.
And I think wasn't one of them swimming and the other was driving a bus?
Yeah, yeah. I don't think the driving a bus was a problem, although you're right, she didn't know how to do it.
Okay.
But they could pretty much work around that. But the bigger problem was the swimming pool, because there was a scene where she was called upon to jump into the water in full nun habit and quote-unquote rescue two difficult teenage girls at this Catholic school who'd been horsing around in the water. And Mary, who honestly told the producer and director, Bill Fry, in advance that she didn't know how to swim.
Oh, okay.
Had also told them that she was taking lessons all during the production so she'd be ready for that scene. And the studio, Columbia, paid for her to take lessons at the YWCA so that she would be up for that. And then comes the day of shooting, and Mary just couldn't go in the water.
Oh.
And she made up, offered up, I should say, all these excuses to the producer as to why she couldn't go in. She was afraid. She didn't want to tell them she hadn't taken the lessons. At heart, Mary was really a very honest, ethical person, and it must have killed her to lie about this.
Mm-hmm.
But she did, in fact, lie, not because she didn't want to take the lessons, but because she feared going into the water would reveal to everybody on the set that she wore a special elastic band on one of her arms to control lymph drainage from having had breast removed. Mm-hmm. And this was late 1960s, and women with breast cancer were not as open about it as they are today. She was terribly afraid of losing work, being branded as unhealthy and damaged goods, and somebody who wouldn't be reliable on a set because of health needs. So she went through hoops in that production and others to keep from everybody involved the news of her breast cancer and the operation. So the producer had to very hastily find a stuntman who was Mary's size, who could quickly don that outfit and get in water and do that scene. So when viewers now see the nun from behind going into the water, that's not Mary. Mm-hmm. And when Mary is shown from the front in the water, there are two two members of the film crew on either side of her underwater holding her up for that, and then quickly walking her out as soon as the director got the shot.
But just for the record, gang, that guy cannot kiss Bing Crosby, so that's, you know, and he can't do the Glass Menagerie, so take that.
There you go.
Yeah. Now, I know near the end of her career, I mean, near the end of her life, she had a nice 1-2 punch with Little Women and then to be the voice in a Disney film in Hunchback of Notre Dame. How did those come about?
Well, Little Women was a story that Mary had loved since she was a little girl, quite honestly. So I think she must have just absolutely loved being offered that film. It's not anything that she pursued or went for or made happen. It was just a role that was offered to her. Ironically, it was offered to her after it was offered to Katharine Hepburn, who was in the original 1930s version. Certainly the only time in Mary's career she received a role because Katharine Hepburn turned it down. That was a difficult film for her because it required a lot of location work in Canada during the winter. Mm. Mary was rather frail at that time. Her sight had deteriorated quite badly. She had trouble getting around. She was sort of isolated on the set, which it was mostly a younger crew. She didn't know people. I would say that was not a terribly pleasant experience for her, even though she enjoyed the story. Whereas Hunchback of Notre Dame was really wonderful for her because it enabled her to show that voice work was something she could do. Mm-hmm. And that meant she wouldn't have to go to stage sets and navigate cables on the floor with her poor eyesight and and confront stairs and stages and things. So voice work at the end became more important to her. And unfortunately, while the taping experience was really nice for her and she was paid well for it and enjoyed it, the filmmakers needed to have some of her lines redone very routinely after everything was in the can, so to speak. But Mary had just passed away.
Right.
So they turned to a few other people who they thought might be able to mimic Mary's voice rather than re-dub the entire role of the film. And the actress Jane Withers did it, and I think people now who watch the film really would have, immense trouble discerning Mary's voice from Jane Withers as Mary in those few scenes. There were about three scenes where Jane did that.
Right. And what those films have in common, kind of what we were talking earlier with White Christmas is, you know, every generation has their Little Women. I know PBS is putting out a new version of Little Women this year. You know, it seems like every decade there is, you know, a BBC masterpiece, PBS, what have you, of classic literature. And for everybody, she's going to be a part of their, you know, for a lot of people, that is their Little Women. So she's a part of that. And of course, you know, her voice is on a disc somewhere in millions of homes for kids, and that's not a bad legacy to have.
Yeah, you're right. That's a nice way to look at it. You're absolutely right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, just curious, when was the last time you were channel surfing and you came across her on the TV?
Oh, that's a good question, and I can answer that really quickly. Now Voyager was shown very recently on the Turner Classic Movies, I think. And I did stop and watched even more than the scenes that Mary's in, because I think it's just a wonderful picture. Have you seen Now Voyager?
It's been a long time, and now that you've brought it up, I'm going to have to go down to the basement and grab it. I tend to have stuff on disc as opposed to DVR or streaming, so... But yeah, I'll be watching that again. I think the last thing I saw was White Christmas because it was December. Do you have a favorite? Do you have a personal favorite of her work that is your go-to?
Well, I think people, smile when I say that of all of her TV work, I really do like that Columbo episode. It just captures so much of her in one scene. And there's also one episode of Here's Lucy, in the Here's Lucy series, where Mary plays a nurse.
Yep.
To Lucille Ball in the hospital, that just cracks me up every time. And but also I do like some of Mary's serious roles. She played a scientist in an episode of Kolchak, sort of a supernatural TV mystery in the mid-70s that was really good.
Darren McGavin.
But film-wise, exactly. Okay, so you know that.
Yeah, Night Stalker. Yeah, of course. I think that's.
I
think that's on MeTV right now. On a regular basis. I'm sorry.
Okay.
You continue. I think we've talked a lot about, and people know her maybe for her her comedic work. What are some of the more dramatic, or because I mean she practically did every genre if I remember right.
Yeah, she did. I mean, she even did musicals on Broadway. And she just loved performing. And even the radio pieces brought her a lot of pleasure. And she took them very seriously. And, she worked in every medium. Most of her work was comic, but not, I wouldn't say, for those who don't know her, I wouldn't say slapstick or farce. No, she just brought sort of a comic energy or a comic element to a serious film. There was something. Oh, have you seen How to Murder Your Wife with Jack Lemmon?
Long, long time ago.
Yeah. Well, it's the only movie in which Mary gets drunk, and she plays drunk so well. And maybe because it's so so atypical for her, the unexpected nature of it makes it even more entertaining. But I really thought she did a spectacular job in that. And some of the nasty parts that she played just a really bitter landlady in something called Fate is the Hunter, a movie with Suzanne Pleshette and Glenn Ford about an investigation into a plane crash.
Mm-hmm.
And that sticks in my mind, too. On the sweet side, there were, the Doris Day movies on Moonlight Bay and By the Light of the Silvery Moon. Those are really memorable.
I also remember. Go ahead.
Sorry.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was going to offer just one more because you're
Please.
Asking for serious ones,
sure.
I realize. There was something in the early 1980s called Touched by Love with Deborah Raffin, where Mary played a teacher's aide. It was one of two movies that she did with Deborah Raffin for Raffin's production company. Mm-hmm. And both of them offered Mary serious roles. And I just thought they were really nice and well done.
You mentioned she had a character that only played drunk once, and she was very particular about certain behavioral traits for her characters, right?
Yeah, you're right. There were things she didn't want her characters to do because she found them personally, morally objectionable, which meant there were roles that she didn't get. There were certain lines of dialogue she refused to say, which meant, again, there were roles she didn't get. So she could have made more money and worked even more often than she did had she not had such a strict lens through which she saw what was acceptable and what wasn't. And sometimes, she really shot herself in the foot with that approach toward work because she lost some great jobs. She was offered, not just offered, but producers really wanted her for a secondary role in Mrs. Doubtfire, the Robin Williams picture
right.
with Sally Field.
Yeah.
And apparently the final version has a lot cut out, and some of the things that were cut out were the parts that Mary had objected to. And I think in the end, she regretted not having taken that, because it turned out to be a very sweet picture with nothing objectionable in it. But the original script for the character that they wanted her for had things that she didn't want to say. And even earlier than that, in the mid-1970s, she was part of a TV ensemble with Barnard Hughes called Doc. Yep. And it was doing very well. And Mary was a little bit full of herself with how popular this show was, and demanded script approval, and said she wanted not just approval over her character's lines, but lines other characters would say, so that if she found something in the script that Barnard Hughes' character, the lead, was to say that she didn't like, that she could have it removed. And the producers got so fed up with that, they fired her. It's one of the few times in her career she was fired, and but not the only time that she suffered for those sort of moral proclamations she had.
And it's funny you mentioned that, because another performance of hers that comes to mind was her episode, her one episode of MASH, where she was a brash talking, heavy drinking lady.
Yeah, yeah, you're right. That was a rather odd episode. It's funny, so many people remember that, and yet I think by today's standards we cringe at it.
Yeah, we do. There's a rape joke that is said. It's not today.
Exactly. No, I mean, the idea that it's funny that a woman falsely claims rape.
Yep.
You know, just feeding into these notions that women who claim such things are making it up. I don't think that would be made today.
No.
But in 1973 or four.
Right.
That was a popular episode.
Yep. Well, I have to mention to folks the reason how we got connected. By the way, ladies and gentlemen, you can use social media for good, not for evil. there's a group of guys that I watch movies with every week when I'm able to, and we were one. It was before the holidays. We were watching The Music Man, which she has a role as one of the cheapy ladies, one of the chicky ladies.
Exactly.
And I wrote on social media that The Music Man reminded me that I wanted to date Shirley Jones, but I wanted to go drinking with Mary Wicks, and. And that, well, after reading the biography, that's not happening. That wouldn't have happened. So, but I think because she had so many stories, and I think the MASH thing probably was also in my head, that she had 1,000 stories to tell, and it would just be fun to huddle up in a corner and hear all of them. But apparently, you'd be over ginger ale. But I'll take it anyway.
And then I'm glad to hear that.
And that's how you responded. So, ladies and gentlemen, it can be done use for good. So,
right. Well, I'm glad you reached out that way, and this has been really fun talking to you and to your listeners in Indiana. And please let them know if they'd like more, they can find the book on Amazon in 4 formats: hardback, paperback, Kindle, and audiobook.
And while I got you here, what else have you written?
Oh, I am a one-book author. This took so many years and so much time. I don't think I'll invest time in another one.
Wow! Okay.
I did this as a labor of love. I make my living working in international development, so this was something completely done for the passion of it. And I don't think I'll do another one. But thanks for asking about that.
Doing what I can to help spread the good word. So, Steve, thank you so much for your time.
No, really appreciate it. Thank you.
Silent Green is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
I can't believe you'd let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!